It's 10 a.m.
Yo. Here we go.
You got a marvelous vibe, and I know it starts from inside. So fill your heart with pride and let your light shine brightly. Yo, don't hide. You're a work of art, unforgettable and off the charts.
Welcome to a podcast dedicated to your mental health. I'm Bailey with the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hi, I'm Christy Edwards. I'm the executive director and a therapist at Centers for Children and Families.
Hi, I'm Melanie Size. I'm the marketing and development director at Centers for Children and Families.
Together, we're bringing you tips and tricks on how to navigate this thing called life. This is Center Solutions. Due to the nature of some of the topics that are discussed, listener discretion is advised.
This is Almost Therapy, which is a part of Center Solutions, but we don't have a guest on the show. Melanie and I get to sit around and talk to Christy about mental health topics in a more casual setting. I love doing Almost Therapy because we just get to be a little more personal with Christy, and she gets to give us all the great tips and tricks.
I love it. Let's do it.
Yeah, so this is still COVID. This is still COVID edition because
still COVID.
Our topic today is I caught the COVID.
To the tune of I shot the sheriff, as you said.
Yes. You can kind of hear it in your head.
Yes, you can.
I caught the COVID.
Yeah.
I won't quit my day job.
I love it. So I thought that I would kind of, I know, Melanie, that you have a lot of new information about COVID, but we wanted to talk about
whenever you test positive for COVID-19, how does that personally affect your mental health, and what are all the emotions that circulate around having a positive test result? And so I wanted to kind of, in a way, interview Christy and let her tell her story, because she tested positive for COVID a long time ago. She's definitely in the clear.
Yes, it was July 1st.
July 1st, so it's been a long time ago, and thankfully you recovered 100%.
I did.
So we wanted to do this episode today because we've seen an uptick in COVID cases, and there's been a lot of new information that has come out about COVID-19, and then we're going to talk to Christy and get some firsthand information about COVID-19 and how that affects your mental health. So, Melanie, do you want to start us off with some information that you've collected?
Yes, we are in a spike right now. We've had a lot of information come out from our hospital, and there are a lot of things that we don't hear in our local area, but that's the link to neurological and mental health issues. And there's some new studies that have come out that are linking COVID-19 to a lot of these mental health issues that are now just coming to light. Many survivors are at greater risk of developing mental illness. Psychiatrists have said Monday after a large study found 20% of those infected with the coronavirus are diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder within 90 days. The study was published in the Lancet Psychiatry Journal, and it analyzed electronic health records of 69 million people in the United States, including more than 62,000 cases of COVID-19. The findings are likely to be the same for those afflicted by COVID-19 worldwide, the researchers have said. And in those 3 months following testing positive for COVID-19, 1 in 5 survivors were recorded as having a first-time diagnosis of anxiety, depression, or insomnia. This was about twice as likely as for other groups of patients in the same period. Now, what makes that so interesting is we've been talking for months about the mental health effects and what we are anticipating. And within our office, Christy and all of our wonderful therapists they're getting to hear some of these things firsthand. Isn't that right, Christy?
That is true. I mean, we're considered frontline workers, and we are seeing many other frontline workers, or just people who are essential workers, or just whose everyday job requires them to be out doing things, and the stress that brings, and all the symptoms that follow that stress.
Yes, we don't have any, as Bailey had mentioned, we have a special guest, and we don't have a special guest, but our special guest sort of is Christy.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been waiting a long time to be invited.
So we want to listen to Christy's story because she actually did have a diagnosis. And Bailey has a lot of questions for you, Christy.
Okay.
I do. I answer them honestly.
Okay. I will answer them as honestly as I possibly can.
Yeah, I'm very lucky because I don't have anyone in my family that has tested positive. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that you're willing to share your story, because even just someone who myself has not tested positive and been very lucky and blessed, I feel like a constant anxiety circulating COVID-19. What was that like for you whenever, tell me even about the testing. I don't even know what the testing is like.
Okay, so I'll just kind of go back to the very beginning. We were going to go to Dallas to see our grandson, who was, you know, an infant, and my son and daughter-in-law said, do you guys mind having a test before you come, because you guys are out in the world working, and they were quarantining. So we said, absolutely, we'll go. We went to get a test. We pulled up in an alley next to this little it's like a little Vital Care, Signature Care building, and they came out into the alley. They, you know, they have you sign all this paperwork, and then they come back and they bring this very long, looks like a big Q-tip, and they tell you they're going to stick it up your nose as far as they can without puncturing anything, and then you're to count to 45 while they leave it there. So,
okay, did that hurt for you, Christy? Did it hurt?
It did not. So, I mean, so, you know, your nose is made to not let things go up there easily. So, you know, there was like initial, it was just like a little pressure. And once it was there, you're aware it was there, but it wasn't like so awful that I'm like, get it out, you know, it was just like there. And then, you know, we counted to 45. The only thing that was a little bit, I don't even know if I'd say it's uncomfortable, it just feels weird. So when they pull it out, it's just like anything that messes with your nose, it made my eyes water. So, I mean, you know, so I have heard the horror stories of people saying it was awful. They, you know, they dug around in there and then they took it out and went up the other nostril. So my experience was not that.
Do you think that perhaps, I wonder, because I know I'm quite the chicken. I don't like it in pain. I'm kind of a baby, mm-hmm. So I would probably be one of the complainers, I think. But I wonder if it's almost like when you get an IV and it depends on who administers the test.
Right, sure.
You know what I mean? So sometimes they can't, they poke around and you're going, give mm-hmm. me a break. And then sometimes it's just easy, no problem.
And it could have been because, you know, I mean, we were already like 3 to 4 months in and, you know, testing at that point. So these people at this little place that we went to, this, you know, kind of emergency care centers, they may have done that so much that they had gotten used to it. But my experience and my husband's experience was the same, and we had recommended other people go there, and their experience was pretty much the same. So I have heard that, you know, once again, other people that went other places had a, you know, maybe a little nastier experience. But it was really that simple. We came home before we even got in the house. The place had called my husband and said, you need to come back. Because you tested negative and your wife tested positive, and we feel like you should be positive as well. So he went back and he came back with another negative test. So I'm questioning, did I really have it? But that was at the time when they were saying there were no false positives. So they're like, mm-hmm. absolutely, you have it. If there was an error, it would have been in your husband's.
What were you feeling whenever you went to go get the test? Did you have anxiety? Were you nervous?
You know, I wasn't, because I didn't feel bad. I'm like, sure, yeah. This is just one of those preventative things. We're going to go get it taken care of. Then we're going to go spend the weekend in Dallas, and we're going to have a great time.
That's different than, I mean, because you guys were just being very smart and cautious, and you wanted to protect your family and the little baby and all that good stuff. But for somebody else who's like, okay, I think I've had exposure or something's mm-hmm. happened, or I'm starting to get a cough, that's a different kind of feeling, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, I would think so. I think that would be the whole stress and anxiety of, you know, then what do I do? Because, you know, basically at that point, if you're following the rules, your life shuts down for the next 14 days. You're not even going to be able to interact with your family. You're going to be quarantined to the back darkest bedroom. If you have the ability to quarantine from your entire family, and somebody's going to be, you know, bringing you food and, you know, wearing gloves and a mask and, and all of those things. So, you know, and it disrupts work, it disrupts your family life, it disrupts, you know, everything. And that happened for me as well, but it was, I didn't really have time to worry about it, I guess is the difference. I didn't have time to be stressed about it.
How long did it take for your test to come positive?
I mean, it, literally we did that, and by the time we drove home, I would say 30 minutes.
What was that like?
Well, the lady calls and she says, have you been exposed to anyone? And I said, yes, I had some exposure at work. And she said, well, you have it. And I'm like, no, I don't. She has a whole denial. No, I don't. I'm going to Dallas. No, but she convinced me that I did. And then, I don't know, a day or two later, and I've told the story a million times, I have a candle that burns really strongly. And I could still smell it, but not to the intensity that I normally could. And that's really, I think, the only thing that I could, you know, really pinpoint as a symptom. Other than maybe I might have been a little tired at the end of the day. But, you know, we work 9-10 hour days someday. So I don't think I ever really connected it with that. But anyway, so I quarantined. Ended up only having to quarantine for 10 days because the health department told me that based on not having any symptoms other than that, that I was free to move about the cabin. So I was able to go back out into the world.
What was isolation like for you?
Well, you know, I like people. So I didn't much care for it. But I will, you know, tell you that I took advantage of it. I watched a lot of Netflix. I caught up on some rest. You know, I did some work from home that, you know, saw emergency clients just through Doxy or Zoom or just over the phone. But it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Now, when was this again?
Okay, so I got my positive test on July the 1st, which I think was a Thursday, if I remember. So we went into the weekend, and then I was out all that next week, and then we got to go back to work, I think, that following Monday or Tuesday. Maybe it was a Tuesday.
Yes.
Whatever 10 days was. So the reality was, it felt like, because we had already had an experience of working from home, right? We'd already shut down the office and moved home at one point. So I kind of just fell back in that, but I had to stay in, you know, I have a little office set up at home, but I had to stay in my bedroom to try to, you know, prevent my husband from getting it. And so being stuck in your bedroom for that long was not that much fun.
I remember, I think what we've talked to about how things have evolved, the mindset around COVID. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it wasn't, part of what we have to do is discern who we're going to talk with about that diagnosis, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And who you can talk to, especially when you're representing a business, and all of those things have shifted. Because we're going through a spike right now. And at that point, it was just like, okay, I'm starting to know a few people. In March, I feel like most of us didn't know anybody. And now, I mean, don't you, I know handfuls of people.
Oh, yeah. Handfuls of people. But, you know, that was a decision that, you know, kind of made early on, you know, and talking to some board members was like, okay, so we've, at that point, I think I have the timeline right. We had shut down. We had opened back up. And so we're thinking, you know, if we put that out there, you know, because, you know, that it might cause a problem, and yet you're struggling with, well, maybe we need to let people know and let them make an informed decision. But I was not seeing, I mean, at that point, we were in our offices. We were not really interacting in the office. I had not seen any clients in the office. So, you know, my biggest fear was, if someone down on my end of the hall had been close enough to me for it to be a problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, luckily that was not the case, but it was like Melanie was saying, you know, whenever you're the one that's going out, you know, representing the agency, you have to be careful because you don't want it to be one of those things that people go, oh, they didn't clean. They've already shut down once. So, you know, I did have some stress about, you know, the work situation.
Right. So as executive director of Centers, it's been hard for a lot of people in that position, because
yeah, like you were saying, you don't know, you want to be careful with what you're saying. And of course, the most important people are the clients and the volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our partners at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Right.
Because if you'll remember, I was in the studio and then was diagnosed right after that. Because we were in the studio on Tuesday and I was diagnosed on Thursday.
Yes, I do remember that. And I know that just brings me to think, okay, so at that point, there still was such a huge, and even to this day, the learning curve is huge, but it's a little bit more, once more people have it, it's terrible. It's not what we want, but it's less, there's less of a stigma to it, and you don't want to incite fear in the people around you unnecessarily, but yet, so everything is about moving with caution. And I think that's part of what we've seen watching some of our, you know, government officials and anybody that is taking care of other people. There's just this cautious way of walking through it. But yeah, because it, you know, the fear factor, I think, has changed. I think initially we all thought, I mean, I know it was scary because we're watching what's unfolding in New York and it's not happening here. Now, we're in a weird position in our town where we're hitting our spike and our hospital is being overrun, and we've kind of developed a little bit of a numbness in a way because of the
going
out. So it's very interesting, just, you know, how it's a grand sociology experiment, which is a whole other topic, but it is interesting. So I think, yeah, there's a little nervousness about letting people know, and then that thought of calling people.
Yes.
How's your family going to be affected?
Well, you know, you're thinking people are going to go, oh, you know, what was wrong with you? Why were you around? Why didn't you, you know?
Shame,
what were
guilt.
You doing? Shame and guilt, all the things that people tell you, you go through those. And I told Melanie, it's kind of like, I think it was Melanie, was it you that said waiting for the results of your COVID test is kind of like being, you know, a young couple waiting to see if you have a pregnancy test that comes back positive. It's like, oh, no, please don't let it be. I mean, it won't be the end of the world, but I don't want it to happen, blah, blah, you know, things like that. But it just feels like people are looking at you like you didn't wash your hands, you didn't socially distance, and you didn't wear a mask. And we did all of those things.
And you can't help that. You can't help it to feel that way. And then I'm sure, you know, having to make those phone calls. Some of the research I was doing, I read a story, and a lady was going through her experience talking about how she spent 24 hours almost trying to go back and research. And this, of course, was someone who lives up north and was diagnosed very early on. And she was calling everybody she'd been in contact with as much as you can know. I mean, obviously, you don't know the cashier at the grocery store, and it can be such a snowball effect to try to figure that out. And then your guilt, and what if I was in contact with someone who has a compromised immune system.
Well, I often talk on here about my 85-year-old mom and my 90-year-old dad. You know, I was taking them food really regularly and going by. While we weren't, like, sitting in a house, we were sitting on the back patio just to be careful. I was still around them, and I had prepared some of that food that I took to them. So, you know, there was a little bit of that. And, you know, thank goodness neither one of them, contracted. Yeah. So, but that was probably the scariest part, was waiting those several days to see how they were going to be.
Yeah. So an example like that, in a situation like that, what advice would you give to someone who does have, like, maybe elderly parents and they tested positive?
Hit your knees and pray. I mean, because that's what I was doing. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, I would just lay in bed sometimes at night thinking, what if something, you know, because they were hungry to see us. And, you know, because their world shut down on March the 16th, just like ours did. And, you know, they're, you know, weren't going to church, weren't seeing their little social group. And so they really wanted to, you know, have some contact, which is important as well. But I would lay in bed thinking, like, what will happen if I gave that to one of them and they die? those were the sleepless nights. That was the biggest guilt. You know, other people, like Melanie was saying, you don't know if you've gotten in contact with the grocery store clerk or, you know, somebody at work or something. But to think about that was what kept me awake and really fearful.
And I can't imagine. And there are actually many instances, because a lot of families pass. I mean, that's, if you think about it, makes sense. You're in a house with family, mm-hmm. especially if you live together. So there are families who have, become the super spreaders within their family, and then someone passes away. Mm-hmm. Those stories just, you know, ring so painfully in my mind when I hear mm-hmm. or read, because it's just tragic, because it's already tragic. Oftentimes people are hospitalized and they are isolated, and then to feel like you don't know if you might have had some part in that. Of course, mm-hmm. I know it's important to always remind ourselves to give ourselves a little grace right now, because unless you were truly intentionally out to hurt someone, if you're trying to sneeze on everyone and you know you have it, I don't know who that person is, but you're a bad person and I don't know you. Yeah. But most people are, I would have to believe, are careful and cognizant once they receive a diagnosis, or hopefully before.
Was there anything that you personally did to kind of get a handle on those thoughts, Chris, to try to keep a positive outlook? I know for you, you didn't have a whole lot of symptoms mm-hmm. compared to some people, but mm-hmm. whenever those thoughts came about, how did you kind of get a handle on those?
Well, I'm a 2:30 or 3 a.m. worrier, so, I normally wake up about that time, and if nothing's really like right in my, in my brain, I can usually go back to sleep, but if there's something there, then I have to deal with it. So, I mean, what I would do, is I would just say, okay, so there's been another day, they're fairly healthy, even, the biggest thing against them is just their age. I just kept saying, we've got another day, and then I'd go back and count how many days it was, how did I see them outside, whatever. So I spent a lot of my time trying to reconstruct when I was around people, because you never want to give somebody anything, because you just don't want to spread anything. No. So, and then I would do some of the, some of the things that we talk about, some of the thought stopping, whenever I would be really anxious, I would get up and I would, come into the little game room, TV room at the house, and sometimes I'd have to do that 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, whenever I would really start thinking about it, because, and I've said this often on the podcast, when your parents live, as long as mine have you assume they're going to live forever, and they're not, and but yet you're going, this can't be the thing that does it, right? So I would do a lot of the thought stopping. I'd do a lot of the, deep breathing. I would do a lot of that anxiety exercise that we talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk to my parents on the phone a lot. How are you feeling? Do you need anything? Those kind of things. So, because I'm right here, but imagine if you had a family that was far away and you couldn't really get to them easily. That would be harder. But for me, it didn't happen.
That's so good. Here's an interesting twist. I think we have had podcasts before, and we've often discussed the disadvantages of isolation and how it, mm-hmm. for your physical health, mm-hmm. how there are so many things that are affected. Loneliness is connected to depression. Isolation mm-hmm. affects cognition, attention, executive function. It could increase the chances of developing dementia, which is in part of these studies that they're seeing. So how ironic is it that at a time, you think of when you're a little kid, what's better than, tea and toast or chicken soup for mom? And now it's like, we got to slide that stuff under the door because we don't want any extra exposure. That's really mm-hmm. kind of counterintuitive to that, human connection that helps us to heal.
Yeah, and what I will tell you, Melanie, when you're reading those off, whenever I'm sitting, laying in there in that bed or sitting up or whatever, and my mind can wander off, I had some of that depression of, what if I've affected somebody? Or, and early on, it's like, is this just the beginning? Are things going to get worse? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm thinking they're telling you nobody can go see you in the hospital. And you, if you're put on a ventilator, chances are you might not get off. So there were some of those thoughts, you know, in those dark nights and, or even during the daytime. So I can see if it's somebody that's already isolated, how big that could feel.
I think, how would you, you know, we talk about the importance of staying connected, but what would you mm-hmm. recommend to somebody who, I guess maybe better than that, what advice would you give to those of us who are not diagnosed for those that are? If we have friends that we know have received that diagnosis or family members, how do we help them to be okay? How can we help their mental health?
Well, and Melanie, I always give you praise because you're really good at this. You stay connected to people in your life. So I think it is, you know, reaching out, saying, is there anything? Can I drop it off in your front porch? You know, what do you need from me? Let's laugh. Let's talk about things. Let's do a virtual Zoom. Any of those things that you can do that will draw them out of that, you know, kind of that scary thinking that can take over your mind whenever you're isolated. So, you know, if you have a friend or a family, just check in every day, even, you know, a couple of times a day if you can. Just say, you know, how are you feeling? You know, don't try to make them feel worse. Like, are you sure you don't have fever? You don't look like you feel good. But, you know, just to be positive and upbeat. And that way I think that they feel, if they can trust you, they might be able to tell you this symptom is a little bit worrisome. And so then sometimes together you can make a decision about what you do with that.
Yes. Boy, it's a big subject, but it's not going away. And I know both you and Bailey have your organizations to lead, and so you mm-hmm. have to be able to be that strong person and give some guidance to your employees as well. And sometimes mm-hmm. that's tough to navigate through. And I'm sure you get the calls. I don't know. I've been around somebody. What do I do?
Mm-hmm. So sure. And you know what I've done and. We've talked about how helpful the chief nursing officer, Kit Bredemus at Midland Memorial, has been our nonprofit. He has returned calls and emails, and he has been fantastic. You know, so sometimes I'll call and he'll say, you know, early on he'll say, no, you don't need to be open. If you've got a way to provide, you know, services, then you don't need to have, you know, you don't need to have people coming in. Or he will send me the latest CDC guidelines and say, this is what we're doing. So, you know, not everybody may be as lucky as we have been to have somebody that closely connected to the health, you know, the physical health care. But just that's what's guided me with making decisions about my employees.
He is such a blessing to our community. We're very lucky to have him.
I think you said it perfectly, Christy. Remember that it's not just you making that decision. Rely on the people in your social circles or your board mm-hmm. or your professional, you know, people that you have professional relationships with, because you're not in it alone. You're not, just as executive director, you're not making that decision on your own. You're making it as a team, because none of us know what we're doing. None of us know what COVID-19 still really is. There's so much of the unknown that we're trying to navigate through on a daily basis.
I agree.
Very true. And we appreciate you sharing that story.
Sure.
We're so glad that you didn't have the major symptoms.
It was not a very glamorous story, but that was my experience with it. And, you know, some of
that's probably... Yeah, I think that's an experience that a lot of people will have is, uh-huh. are you kidding me? I can't believe I have this. And it knocks mm-hmm. you down and but you feel like you can run a marathon.
Exactly.
So I would think even anger plays a big role in that, and denial of, I don't have COVID-19. It's not true. Right?
That was where I went first. So I'm like, no, my bag is packed. I'm going to Dallas. You're wrong. So, you know, it is part of that. And then you start going, okay, where were we? Where did we go wrong? Who did we, you know, was it the lady that cleans the house? Was it the, you know, was it the person at the grocery store? Was it an employee? You know, then you kind of start looking to say, oh, it was you. And then that's why I was a little hesitant at first. I didn't want people to look at me like that.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost kind of like the stages of grief. Maybe there's going to be a new methodology, and it's going to be the stages of COVID realization.
I feel like Christy could make those steps up. I feel like she could totally. It's a little bit of denial, a little bit of anger, you know, all of the grief greatest hits. I think it's just something.
On.
Yeah, and it's something that's going to become very familiar for so many of us. I mean, I think now it's kind of like, instead of waiting around, like, I don't know. I don't know about you, Bailey, but sometimes I'm just going, when am I next? you're waiting for your number to be up.
I feel like I'm on a game show. You know that show where the floor falls out? Like, that roulette show? And the floor falls out on certain people? I feel like I'm saying I'm trying to avoid it like the plague. And that rings so true. Like, that saying is so accurate.
I don't know. It's so funny when you hear that now. The plague, it just...
Yeah.
Now you're like, wait a minute, that's really happening. That's us.
That's what we're living through. I was telling somebody today, I said, I think at this point, we've got to pray for a vaccine because I do not think the virus is leaving anytime soon. And I'm not, you know, I'm not anybody in the medical field, but just from what you're hearing and seeing, I think, you know, we keep saying we're just ready for this virus to go away. So I think we've got to shift and say we've got to figure out another way. We've got to figure out a way to deal with the virus. I don't think it's going away.
Right. No, we have to. And part of that, big part of that, is how to handle it in terms of our mental health. Mm-hmm. And if you are having concerns, please remember that Centers is here for you, and we are available for free for many of our frontline workers.
Right.
So if you think you are a frontline worker, chances are you are. Give us a call and we can help you out because we're not all in it at the same level, but we definitely are facing the same thing together, and we want to be able to help as many people as we possibly can.
Yes, we do.
Christy, can you end the show with some positive words of advice? If you test positive for COVID-19, give us some hopeful insight. Give us some of your teachings.
Some of my teachings. Yeah. Well, I think what we've got to remember is the physical and the mental go hand in hand. And if you are, you know, pretty optimistic and proactive, and you're like, you know, this has happened, but I'm not going to just, you know, pull the covers over my head and hope that it goes away. My doctor had me get outside and get 20 minutes of sunshine every day. My doctor said eating healthy during this time. So I feel like if you're not passive in your recovery, then you might have if you are passive in your recovery, you might have a harder time. So be proactive, be active, get out and do the things that people have said worked for them. Now, it's not going to work. Unfortunately, it's not going to work for everybody. So they're going to be, you know, we're going to lose more people. But I think for those of us that are not going to have those most serious cases, it's important to stay positive and do those things.
Good advice.
That's great.
Thank you so much, Christy.
Thank you.
That was
You're
awesome.
Welcome. You're welcome.
Center Solutions is a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. Post-production work is done by Bailey Hennis. Content is provided by Melanie Size and Christy Edwards. Contact Centers for Children and Families at 432-570-1084 or the Recording Library, 432-682-2731. Email Melanie with questions you want answered on the show at msize@centerstexas.org. That's msize@centerstx.org.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I am Herbert Gilmore, and this is Prevention Magazine. I'll be reading articles from the November 2020 issue. The first article is, How to Tell If Your Nasty Cold Is Actually the Flu, According to Doctors, by Jessica Magala and Brittany Risher. This article was medically reviewed by Raj Dasgupta, MD, an assistant professor of clinical medicine and a member of the Prevention Medical Review Board. When you're sick, all you care about is feeling less miserable. But once the temps drop during fall and winter, it can be tricky to figure out if you're dealing with the flu or a common cold. That's because many of the symptoms overlap, but there is one major difference. The flu is like a cold on steroids, says Joseph Ladapo, MD, PhD, professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles. I've heard patients say, "This is the worst I've ever felt in my life." Falling ill may be especially confusing this season, thanks to the coronavirus pandemic. Read about the difference between COVID-19 and cold symptoms. In order to stop your sniffles, you need to know what's causing them in the first place. Here, the doctors explain how to distinguish a cold from the flu so you can seek treatment that will actually make you feel better. Part of the reason it can be tricky to know whether you have the flu or a cold is simply because there are only a few minor differences between their symptoms. Cold symptoms. In general, cold symptoms show up primarily above your neck. A runny nose, coughs and sneezing, sore throat, slightly swollen glands, minor aches and pains. Flu symptoms. This includes symptoms above and below your neck. You have all the signs of a cold plus the following. A fever over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Chest coughs. Weakness and fatigue. Headaches. Chills. Vomiting. Diarrhea. Full body aches. How do I know if I have the flu or a cold? The biggest differences between the symptoms of influenza and a cold are their severity and how quickly they develop. With the flu, one day you're feeling okay, and the next, all your symptoms arise, says Michael P. Angaron, D.O., professor of infectious diseases at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Compared to the flu, a cold is milder and symptoms gradually set in. If you don't feel horrible, you probably don't have the flu, Dr. Ladapo says. Still not sure. Ask yourself these questions. How severe does this feel? Cold. You feel mildly icky and things get worse slowly. The first signs might include slight aches, a scratchy throat, a headache, and or a low-grade fever. Flu. The flu hits you like a speeding train. You may feel feverish at work, and by the time you get home, you can barely muster enough energy to climb your porch steps. Every inch of you aches. Can I get out of bed? Cold. Yes, you can walk around. Though you might not want to commute to work or schlep the kids around, you can manage. Flu. Absolutely not. You're flat on your back. Extreme fatigue is going to incapacitate you for at least a few days. Cold versus flu treatment. If you aren't sure which you have and how to treat it, talk to your healthcare provider over the phone or make an appointment to see them in person, Dr. Angaron recommends. Cold treatment. Tylenol Extra Strength Rapid Release Gels with acetaminophen. Take it easy and rest up. Keep a water bottle nearby to ensure you're staying hydrated. Popping a pain reliever like ibuprofen or acetaminophen may temporarily perk you up. A cold can follow you around for as long as 10 days, but you don't have to quarantine yourself the entire time. Once you start feeling better, you're no longer very contagious, so you can head back to work as long as you're up to it. Flu treatment. Plan to hunker down for 3 to 7 days and ask your MD about Tamiflu. If taken within 48 hours, it will help you get better sooner and reduce the chance that you'll pass the virus to others, says William Schaffner, MD, an infectious disease expert and professor of preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University. You can go back to a normal life 24 hours after your fever recedes on its own, but you'll probably be moving slowly for a bit. Want to see a doctor about your cold or flu symptoms? Call your doctor if you experience symptoms that overlap with signs of COVID-19, contact with someone diagnosed with COVID-19, trouble breathing or eating, call ASAP. You have a fever higher than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. You're experiencing severe vomiting or diarrhea. Coughing lasting longer than 10 days is driving you crazy or making it hard to sleep. Upper respiratory symptoms last more than a week or 10 days. That article was how to tell if your nasty cold is actually the flu, according to doctors, by Jessica Magala and Brittany Risher. The next article is How to Cope with Seasonal Depression During the COVID-19 Pandemic by Corin Miller. When the coronavirus pandemic first hit the U.S. in the spring, we still had one thing to look forward to in otherwise dark start to the year: sunshine. But now, as COVID-19 cases continue to hit all-time highs in the U.S., with no signs of slowing down, the country is approaching a long and difficult winter. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, symptoms of anxiety and depression have increased considerably among American adults this year. With that, mental health experts fear a rise in seasonal affective disorder, SAD, a form of depression that hits people when the days get shorter and darker in the fall and winter due to daylight savings time, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. SAD affects up to 15% of those who have pre-existing depression, says Samara McCutcheon, MD, a psychiatrist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. With the added stressors of COVID-19, the U.S. election, the holidays, and economic hardships, it is possible that the incidence of SAD may increase, or the severity could be worse for those who typically experience it. SAD can cause a range of symptoms, including signs of major depression, like feelings of sadness or hopelessness, most of the day, low energy, and difficulty concentrating or sleeping. But it can also include symptoms like oversleeping, overeating, weight gain, isolating from friends or family. As the days get longer, sunnier in the spring, your mood generally starts to lift again, but coping with the symptoms for months can be debilitating for certain people. The pandemic is also complicating treatment options. Typically, experts recommend being more social and getting outdoors, exercising, and therapy for seasonal depression, all of which can be challenged by the precautions we must take for COVID-19, says Gail Saltz, MD, an associate professor of psychiatry at the NY Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell School of Medicine, and host of Personology Podcast from iHeartRadio. There's hope, though, if you suffer from SAD. Experts say there are pandemic-safe options you can try to lift your mood and take control of your symptoms. UV-free 1000 Lux Bright LED Sun Lamp. Light therapy has been considered the mainstay of SAD treatment since the 1980s. Per the NIMH, the goal is to expose yourself to bright light every day to make up for the lack of natural sunshine in the winter. For the treatment, you simply sit in front of a CF bright light box known as a happy light. Light therapy lamps, or SAD lights, which is about 20 times brighter than ordinary light, it is generally recommended to aim for 30 to 45 minutes a day, typically first thing in the morning from fall to spring. Think of this as a great time to read, meditate, or do stress-relieving activities. This has been shown to be a good treatment for true SAD, with little to no side effects, Dr. Saltz says. She emphasizes true because it is important to see a mental health professional like a psychiatrist to ensure your symptoms are due to SAD instead of another underlying condition. That way you will have guidance on the best treatment. Get your vitamin D levels checked. Depression has been linked to low vitamin D levels. You can get the essential nutrient through a limited amount of foods like fatty fish and mushrooms, but it's primarily produced in the body when ultraviolet rays from sunlight hit the skin. Research is mixed on whether taking a vitamin D supplement can truly help with SAD, but it's worth noting that most people don't get enough of it, even those without depression. One often cited study in the journal Nutrition Research suggests nearly 42% of Americans are vitamin D deficient. That's why Dr. Saltz says it generally doesn't hurt to take a vitamin D supplement, particularly in the winter. While this is not a treatment for depression per se, it can help ensure your levels are more normal, she says. Because there's no universal recommendation for optimal intake, talk to your doctor before popping a pill. Before starting a vitamin D supplement, it is recommended to have vitamin D levels evaluated by your primary care physician to help determine the best dose. says Hain M. Hoffman, a neurologist and assistant professor at Michigan State University. Consider seeing a therapist. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a form of talk therapy that helps you learn coping mechanisms in difficult situations. There's also a form called CBT-SAD, which was specifically created for people with SAD per the NIMH. It is usually conducted in 2 weekly gap sessions for 6 weeks and focuses on replacing negative thoughts related to the winter season with more positive thoughts. CBT-SAD also uses a process called behavioral activation, which helps individuals ID and plan mood-boosting indoor or outdoor winter activities. Make an effort to get outside every day. Of course, this is a natural form of light therapy. Being outdoors, even when it's cold, offers a double whammy. You can enjoy time in nature, which research suggests can be helpful for depression, and you'll be exposed to much-needed sunlight, Dr. Salt says. Even if you're working from home and need to take a break, getting outside for a 20-minute walk can work wonders, Barrett says. In addition to light, getting more exercise, whether you're strolling through the park or cycling indoors to your favorite music, can help lift your spirits. Limit the amount of news you consume. If you have SAD, you're already struggling with the change in the season, but adding stressful news on top of that can make things worse. News, especially these days, is very triggering for many people's anxiety and stress level, which in turn is not helpful to mood, Dr. Salt says. A constant flow of negative information does not give your mind a break for rest, respite, and positivity. That doesn't mean you have to completely check out, though. Instead, Dr. Salt recommends limiting your exposure to news, for instance. Have a dedicated time when you check in with the news 2 to 3 times a day, but get rid of your phone alerts, she says. Connect with friends and family in a safe way. Dr. Salt says connecting with loved ones is a super important for people struggling with seasonal depression. Having social support helps with mood, she says. On the other hand, loneliness exacerbates anxiety and depression. However, the CDC emphasizes traveling and indoor holiday gatherings such as large family dinners are a high-risk activity for COVID-19 transmission. Even if you can't be with important people in your life, talking virtually is the next best thing, Dr. Salt says. Talk to your doctor about medication if needed. If a combination of remedies above don't seem to be helping, medication may be needed, particularly if the depression is moderate to severe, Dr. Salt says. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, are a form of antidepressants typically used to treat SAD, per the NIMH. The Food and Drug Administration has also approved another drug, bupropion, which can prevent seasonal major depressive episodes from coming back when it's taken daily from the fall until the following early spring. If you suspect you have SAD or at risk of developing SAD, see your physician who can prescribe antidepressants specifically for you, Hoffman says. Antidepressants are in most cases effective at treating SAD. That article was How to Cope with Seasonal Depression During the COVID-19 Pandemic by Corin Miller. The next article is When an airline served nuts on my flight, I almost died in front of my kids, by Tricia Powell, as told to Nicole Blades. Only 2 hours and we're home. I told myself as family and I boarded our flight back to Pennsylvania. We'd just spent a week at Disney World on our first official family vacation with the kids. My husband's family had joined us too. Together we watched my daughter, a Princess Mega fan, get made up at the Bibbidi Bibbidi Boutique and saw my son light up as he met some of his favorite characters. It was truly magical. For me, being able to eat at restaurants with my family was a rare treat. I have severe food allergies and I'm always on high alert to manage them. At Disney, the head chef came out to each restaurant to go over my list of forbidden foods, making suggestions about how to alter the dishes to make them safe. And my list is a long one. I can't eat fresh fruit, raw veggies, shellfish, certain fish, seeds, and nuts. In college, while doing lab work as a biology major, I learned that I have severe latex allergy. These allergies have only gotten worse as I've gotten older. Now, at 38, I've lost count of how many times I've used an EpiPen to save my own life. It's a burden, and it takes an emotional toll, always having to wonder, what's in that food? Is it safe? About a month before the trip, my husband made our airlines aware of my nut allergy, and a rep told him they would not be serving nuts on board. I got through our flight to Florida on 7 days in Disney World without trouble. Our return flight was overbooked, though that's when things started to break down. While we thought we'd all be enjoying first-class flight, an upgrade, we excitedly splurged on before the trip when we saw a last-minute deal. My husband John and I were forced to split up. He was bumped back to coach with our almost 5-year-old daughter, and I stayed in first class along with our 1.5-year-old son. Only 2 hours, and then we're home, I kept thinking. Would you like a snack? I heard an attendant ask midway through the flight. I looked up and my heart dropped. She held those little trays of mixed nuts. It looked like they'd be freshly roasted right there on the plane. I'm allergic to nuts, I said. Oh, I'm not serving nuts, she said. I'm allergic to all nuts, I clarified, but she then proceeded to ask a man sitting next to me if he would like some. I ran to John and handed him the baby so I could hide in the bathroom. An airplane, such a confined space, but I kept thinking about the particles from the roasted nuts that could be floating in the recirculated air. When I left the bathroom a short time later, John asked if I was okay, but my voice was already sounded funny. It's the first to go when I have an allergic reaction. I continued to my seat and hit the attendant call button, squeezing every last drop of my pre-dose vials of Benadryl. Because it was such a short flight, we'd been assured nuts would not be on board. I didn't think I'd need to bring several vials, but my airways were already closing, and by the time the attendant arrived, I could not talk at all. I whipped out my EpiPen and jammed it into my right thigh. But knowing that its effectiveness only lasts between 10 and 20 minutes, and that the recycled airplane air meant the allergen was still going to affect me, I panicked even more. It felt like a bear was squeezing my chest, and I could not get out of its tight grip. I jammed a second EpiPen into my thigh again and started gasping for air. The man next to me shouted to everyone in first class, "She's allergic to nuts. Get rid of your nuts." I kept thinking, I don't want to die in front of my son. I didn't even say goodbye to my daughter. My eyes started tearing up because I couldn't breathe. My husband, who was a surgeon, asked the flight attendant what medical supplies they had on hand. It was clear there was no protocol in place for situations like this. John put our son in front on my lap while he searched for any other medical supplies besides oxygen and rubber gloves that they had. The baby looked up at me and cried, "Mama, Mama." I kept thinking, I don't want to die in front of my son. I didn't even say goodbye to my daughter, asleep in the black of the plane. I'm not ready to leave my babies. Someone gave me oxygen. Another flight attendant applied an ice pack to the back of my neck. Why the ice pack? I have no clue. I noticed her latex gloves and became even more frantic. John yelled, "Stop touching her. She's allergic to your gloves." The flight crew asked if we wished to divert the plane to Charlotte, North Carolina. John said yes, and the captain made an emergency landing announcement. Thankfully, Charlotte Douglas Airport had an on-site medics, and they took me off the plane and administered IV medications. My daughter woke up to witness a commotion. It had traumatized her, leaving her with severe separation anxiety. She's still in weekly PTSD therapy sessions at Children's Crisis Treatment Center. In the ambulance, the medical team stabilized me. I crashed about 15 minutes later and went completely unresponsive. The lights and sirens went on and the ambulance sped off to the hospital. When we arrived, they rolled me out and John covered the kids' eyes so they wouldn't see my lifeless body, passed by while the medic provided resuscitation breaths. I slowly came to and saw a small crowd of people rushing around me to save my life. They kept saying, "She ate peanuts." I wanted to scream, "I didn't eat nuts. I would never eat nuts." After being admitted and monitored in the ER, I was admitted to the hospital for observation and discharged the next day. But my problems didn't end there. I have another medical condition called thoracic outlet syndrome, TOS, which causes me to lose my pulse in my left arm. The anaphylactic reaction to the nuts on the plane caused severe pain and discomfort. 6 months after my flight nightmare, it was clear that physical therapy and Botox injections weren't cutting it. I needed major surgery, and afterwards I was in a sling, unable to pick up my young son for 6 months, and I continued to struggle a year later. With the scar under my arm, I reminded this whole ordeal every morning when I shower and put on deodorant. I have terrible flashbacks in my sleep and see a PTSD therapist weekly. I don't know when or if I'll ever be able to step on a plane again. And all this because of roasted nuts served on a flight. More than a year later, we're still waiting for our apology. Something needs to change, and it can't wait until someone with a food allergy dies on a plane because nuts were served. Protocols must be put in place so people like me can feel safe while confined 30,000 feet in the air. Smoking on planes has been banned since 1988. With increased prevalence of nut allergies in this country, why can't nuts be banned? Why can't more airlines do what Southwest Airlines recently did, banning peanuts on all flights? Shouldn't my life mean more than an airline snack? I know we can't control what passengers bring on a flight, but should my life and the lives of others like me mean more than an airline snack? Many people don't understand because they're not affected by a life-threatening allergy, and they don't have family or friends who are affected by allergies either. This lack of understanding manifests as anger over more eliminated snack, but I believe their feelings would change if it were their loved ones in my shoes. No one chooses to have their allergies, but I've chosen to start a petition to the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. State Department of Transportation asking to ban all nuts on airlines. I really do believe that everything happens for a reason, and if my terrifying experience may help save a life, then it would have been worth it. I urge you to help bring awareness and change by signing and sharing the petition. The airline did respond to goodhousekeeping.com request to comment below. We recognize that some passengers are allergic to peanut and other tree nuts. Although we do not serve peanuts, we do serve other nut products such as warm nuts, and there may be trace elements of unspecified nut ingredient, including peanut oils, in meals and snacks. Requests that we not serve any particular foods, including tree nuts, on flights cannot be granted. We're not able to provide nut buffer zones, nor are we able to allow passengers to pre-board to wipe down seats and tray tables. Our planes are cleaned regularly, but these cleans are not designed to ensure the removal of nut allergies, nor are our air filtration systems designed to remove nut allergens. Additionally, other customers may choose to bring peanuts or other tree nuts on board. Therefore, we're unable to guarantee that customers will not be exposed to peanuts or other tree nuts during flight, and we strongly encourage customers to take all necessary medications to prepare for a possibility of exposure. That article was, "When an airline served nuts on my flight, I almost died in front of my kids," by Tricia Powell, as told by Nicole Blades. The next article is, "What It's Really Like Living with Narcolepsy," by Alyssa Walker, as told by Emily Schiffer. My name is Alyssa Walker, and I am 27 years old. I am from Houston, Texas, and I'm a flight attendant living with narcolepsy. In high school, I was extremely active. If it wasn't track or field or basketball, it was dance rehearsal or pageant practice. I was always on the go. So if I got tired after sitting more than 20 minutes, it didn't seem weird or concerning. But then, as a freshman in college, I started having trouble making it to my classes on time. I would wake up, only fall back asleep, and dream that I was getting ready. I stopped going to see my parents as frequently because I couldn't make the hour and 15-minute drive home without falling asleep on the road. Thankfully, I never had an accident. I was extremely irritable all the time. I would cry over silly things like it being too hot outside, or get overwhelmed by little problems like school assignments. The more I stressed, the sleepier I would get. By the beginning of my sophomore year, I was sleeping more than I was awake. That semester, I failed all my classes and lost both my jobs. Looking for answers, I decided to research sleep disorders and told my primary care doctor I thought something was wrong. I referred to a sleep specialist and received my narcolepsy diagnosis in 2013 at the age of 20. Before I met with the specialist, I thought I was only experiencing excessive daytime sleepiness. But it turned out that I suffer from all five symptoms associated with narcolepsy, which, in addition to daytime sleepiness, includes hallucinations, sleep disruption, sleep paralysis, yes, it's as scary as it sounds, and cataplexy. That's when all the muscles suddenly lose their tension and stiffness and become floppy while you're awake, leading to the loss of voluntary muscle control. There are two types of narcolepsy. Type 1 is cataplexy, and type 2 is without type 1, usually genetic. And that's what I have. I assumed that I received narcolepsy from my father's side. His brother passed away before I was born, but he experienced sleep paralysis, and he wouldn't even sleep with a broom next to his bed, which according to an old myth could stop it from happening. Managing my condition. Knowing that narcolepsy is genetic makes me worry about passing it to my children one day. I also worry about not being able to be a good mother because I'm too tired. When I have these thoughts, I remind myself of all the things I've accomplished in spite of narcolepsy. I know being a mom won't be easy, but I'm confident I can do it. This is because I've learned ways to manage my symptoms. I have a medication